Next case is 225-513, Shira Sue Stevens, Administratrix versus Emily Ackman. Mr. Wills.
May it please the Court, my name is Ted Wills, and I represent Shira Sue Stevens in this case against Emily Ackman in the city of Middletown. I'd like to request, if I could, to have 3 minutes of time.
Okay, you need to watch your time there on the clock.
For the underlying claim, we have two issues here. One, jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals, and the other one is, of course, the underlying claim that the Court of Appeals dealt with. The law in that underlying claim starts with two statutory provisions, 2744-02B3 and 723-01. Both of those statutes give municipalities or political subdivisions the duty to keep their roads, avenues, streets in repair and free from nuisance. The Ohio Supreme Court in the case Dickerhoof has interpreted 723-01 to say that that duty not only applies to the area between the white lines on the roadway, but to the shoulder.
Perhaps you ought to first address the threshold issue of whether or not this is the final appealable order. And I gather that you concede that if it is not, this court cannot address the underlying issue.
Well, I really don't concede that. No. I mean, I'm glad to go through that. First of all, I think that the Court of Appeals did not have jurisdiction to hear this case. And the reason was very simply that, prior to the interlocutory appeal provision, denials of summary judgment were not final appeal orders. And then the hearing, the pendency of interlocutory appeal for this case, this court declared the interlocutory appeal provision to be unconstitutional in Sheward, and subsequently we had a half a dozen other cases that confirmed that and say that that interlocutory appeal provision is no longer applicable.
So we had House Bill 215, didn't we not, that said the same, gave the same right of appeal, which was not expressly found to be unconstitutional in Sheward. So what do we then? That's our problem, isn't it? What do we do with House Bill 215? Is it a reenactment of, or an enactment? I'm not sure it's a reenactment, but it can be an enactment, can it not be?
Well, I think the simple reading of that is that House Bill 215 only amended a portion of that statute out of Section B and not Section C, the interlocutory appeal provision, so there was no reenactment of that interlocutory appeal provision. So the interlocutory appeal provision from Section C still remained in House Bill 350, and because it remained in House Bill 350, it was overruled by Schumer. I think it's a very simple, straightforward analysis.
Doesn't that argument put us in a sort of a morass with a case such as this, where the court sort of broadly says an act that has a lot of different provisions and is unconstitutional? We have another separate section of the code that gives the same rights. It means we have to go back through statutory history and try to determine whether the General Assembly, whether all of its acts or whether certain acts are unconstitutional or not. Wouldn't it be better just to take the last act of the General Assembly and say that's the statute that applies?
Well, I mean, it may be better.
I mean, not, well, better for the purposes of...
I'm just arguing what, you know, what the law says. In fact, I mean, it might be easier for me to just concede that whole jurisdictional issue, because I would like, you know, to hear this court's answer on underlying merits. We, this young man was killed in 1994, and we are still not able to go to trial. We haven't even completed discovery in this case because of this interlocutory appeal. And so we are looking at years down the line, if this case is sent back for an answer on the underlying merits. But I just have to go with what this court said in Hubbard, was that the interlocutory appeal provision was overruled.
In Hubbard, 215 was not argued. That's, and there was some sense among the court that should have been, but it was not briefed, not argued, so we don't really have... Hubbard is, it does stand for, you know, what you say, but it we didn't really have the 215 issue briefed, and we didn't consider it in Hubbard, so we've got that quirk, I guess.
That's fine. And, Your Honor...
Did you believe this case came in on the conflict and, I guess, the jurisdictional appeal on, really, on the issue of whether a berm was an edge drop as opposed to the 2744 question?
Well, it came out.
Well,
I mean, that's what I
maybe got not in, maybe not in our minds.
Well, I mean, there was a conflict certified between this case and Thompson on the berm issue, and I was invited to brief it, so I did it.
And I
think that this court has jurisdiction over certified questions. In fact, looking at very fine points of analysis from this court, recently in the case Waters versus Fishing Well, this court took in a certified conflict on a case for the issue itself was whether the Court of Appeals had jurisdiction. But this court answered that certified question. It did not dismiss that case on the grounds that this court did not have jurisdiction. It answered the question.
Let's stay with this case, though.
Right.
Let's stay with this case. The if 215 does not resuscitate 2744.02c, I think it was, then that ends this case today without going to that issue, doesn't it?
That's what I disagree with, and I think that's what Waters v. Winwell answered.
Okay, but the Court of Appeals would not have had jurisdiction to even entertain the appeal, would they?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
But once
now,
it's certified, I think it's taken into this court, and this court has jurisdiction to answer a certified question. Counsel.
Okay, just a minute, Paul. The last, I want to go with it, if that is the ruling, then it goes back to the trial court on what, for trial?
If this court dismisses the case based on the jurisdictional issue...
If we say that 215 didn't resuscitate, bring back the provisional appeal, interlocutory appeal.
Right.
So that therefore it was not proper to appeal the immunity issue.
Then I would say that the Court of Appeals did not have jurisdiction to go back to the trial court. Then I am sure that the Middletown would move for summary judgments based on the underlying merits and the, you know, the advisory opinion, whatever, from the Middletown or Butler County Court of Appeals and other cases that I've now cited.
Which is what you want.
But then, using that as precedent, then I'm out again, and then I have to go to the Court of Appeals again, and they rule for or against, and then we have to come back here to have the merits addressed. It's just an unbelievably complicated and time-consuming pattern when this court has already answered at least once a certified question when the Court of Appeals did not have jurisdiction. This court answered that certified question. It did not dismissed the case for one jurisdiction at the Supreme Court level. It answered the question and said the Court of Appeals did not have jurisdiction and sent it back. And so I submit that under that and under the Constitution, which gives the Supreme Court, yes.
Could you help me maybe understand what the Court of Appeals did do?
Yes.
I thought that they avoided the question of 2744-02C altogether. They said that's moot because they went to the liability question under an analysis that this was an appeal of a special proceeding. And they have knocked you out saying as a matter of law on the facts there can be no liability to the city because this is as a matter of law not a popular.
Well, I think that's a fair summary. But
and they didn't address the question of whether or not that particular statute allowing interlocutory appeal on every issue of whether or not sovereign immunity kicks in. They didn't address that.
They did subsequently when I moved for the certification, they did say that they felt 215 inactive. But then you're right.
But in their original opinion, they went under. And so you've got this opinion hanging out there that says even if the city is liable or has exposure, that on the facts of this, as a matter of law, you have no case.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's dead wrong in a bigger book.
And the trial court said you did.
Yes.
The trial court said you've got enough to get to a jury.
Right. And under Dickerberg, I think that's it very, very simple. There's no fact, there's no legal distinction that judges can and courts can make between the pothole in Dickerberg and the Edgecroft in this case. I mean, we'd just be going off into flights of fancy where every municipality then would just haul every defective burn, an Edgecroft, and just by calling it that, there would not be liability. But our expert in the case, this is a man who has written the book on roadway defects. He says that there's no difference. There's no safety difference between the condition of the road going burn in the Roosevelt Avenue and the pothole, or what do you want to call it, in different book. The dangers of the roadway is exactly the same. And in fact, the people from Middletown, the engineers, the people from the city maintenance department, they all testify that these are a danger to traffic, pulling, they get drawn off the roadway for one reason or another. Coming back onto the roadway is a danger to traffic because it can cause them to lose control. And it just raises a question of fact as to whether it makes the highway safe or reasonable traffic. But if I could just go back briefly to this issue of the jurisdiction and underlying merits. My concern is that if this court doesn't rule on underlying merits, we go back to trial court. The trial court then would be bound by these, by the advisory opinion from the Court of Appeals. And the other cases now that are citing that would rule against us. Then we come up to Court of Appeals, back and forth there, who knows which way it goes, then back up here again before we get to try a case. This should never has gone to the Court of Appeals in the first place. If they would have
got that's what your point is, you're dead on the merits unless you go clear back, come back to the Court of Appeals, because they've already said on these facts, you're dead.
That's
so
right.
You've got to get your case clear back here,
right,
on the merits.
Yeah, and it's already here.
Or if you had no case.
That's right, and it's already here. And this court has a certified question.
Or some other case in the meantime could address issues that would help resolve it, even when you got back to the trial court.
I mean, that's going to be all part of my client waiting for a case to work its way up here while I'm fighting to get back to the sort. I just think that's...
Jurisdiction, though, is, jurisdiction is, can't really get around it if we don't have jurisdiction.
Well,
even
I mean,
if we've, it's inefficient,
I mean,
no doubt
sure,
about it.
It's inefficient, but if the court looks at the prior opinion, so you've got a case where you say that the this court has the power to answer certified questions from the federal court without actually exercising jurisdiction. You say, you know, we have this duty.
That's a special rule we set aside.
But at least the opinion was given without jurisdiction. So jurisdiction is not a bar. And in this case also, we have a prior case where this court ruled on the merits, answered the certified question.
It just happened to be that the final appealable order was that was the certified conflict
right.
issue.
That's right.
So it's not that we ruled on the merits, that it just so happened the merits were the jurisdictional issue.
Yeah. But if this court did not have jurisdiction, the only proper way they'd be able to have would say dismiss for one of
Well, you write an opinion even on a jurisdictional issue.
Pardon?
I'm sorry, you write an opinion even on a jurisdictional issue, which was the case in Walters.
Well, yeah, I understand, but my argument is that if the court would not have answered the certified question, it would have dismissed the case for one of jurisdiction, and it did not do that answer mm-hmm. the
Yeah, you've used your time, Mr. Wills. Thank you. Mr. Gary.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Robert Gary, representing the city of Middletown in this case. I think I would like to at least clear up some of the procedural issues that have been raised by the panel, at least at this particular level. First of all, this is a very unusual procedural situation. We were ready to argue this case in the Court of Appeals when this court rendered its decision to shoot it. I don't think the Court of Appeals or the parties had any sufficient time to really analyze what Shuler did in terms of the final appeal of the order issue and all of that. And certainly, we didn't have much time to think about the 215 issue. We're talking about a matter of days from the time of Shuler to the time of the
court. Let me ask you on the reenactment argument in your brief, in the briefs. 215 was, I think I'm correct in my chronology here, and correct me if I'm wrong, that 215 was enacted after 350, but before 350 was declared to be unconstitutional.
That's correct.
So why doesn't 215 stand on its own without having to ask, you know, do this very technical sort of analysis of whether it's a reenactment, whether the words are in uppercase letters and all that?
I believe 215 does stand on its own. That the legislature, for whatever reason, revised that portion that we're dealing with here. Let's just talk about this portion, because 215 did a lot of other
things. Right.
But in terms of 2744.02c, it repealed prior enactment, and then went and said, now we have a new 2744.02c, and it provides that there's a final appeal of the order for when denial of summary judgment on immunity. I believe that that is what's controlling.
And we have to just, I'm going to be a little tedious here, we have to apply reenactment principles because 215 did repeal the previous section. So that's why it's, if 215 had been enacted without any reference to any history, I guess then it would be maybe not a reenactment, but I
would prefer to call it an enactment
yeah.
for this reason. When the court in Shuler found that House Bill 350 was unconstitutional in total, which included the 2744.02c then in existence, the legal effect of that is if it had never existed. And that's the court has said that on a number of occasions, when you hold something on...
That's this fiction that we've all... American jurisprudence has created, right? Yeah, never existed.
215, which does exist now, which was in place at the time that both the trial court and the court of appeals then went had jurisdiction on the final appeal of the order as it then in existence. But of course, none of us could have anticipated, you know, Shuler coming along and doing what he did. But the trial court obviously wanted this issue decided because the trial court itself said it's a final appeal of the order under 2744.02c. That's not necessarily determinative, but certainly it would give some indication that this is an issue that ought to be decided at this level by this court.
But 215 didn't comply with RC 101.53 for the entire statute. It only had the capitalized language of portion, isn't that correct?
That is correct, but I believe that we've also pointed out, it may be coming up in an argument later on today, is that there were other changes made also in there. So, granted, we can't control whether the legislature followed that technical part of it in terms of rewriting.
But aren't they required to do that?
They might be, but does that mean that the statute is then non-existent? I don't believe so, because now what we're talking about is essentially the logic that might be wipe out everything the legislature did there. Nobody's arguing that. Nobody, at least at this point, has argued as far as we're concerned. 215 is unconstitutional for some reason. We're not here dealing with that. That constitutionality has been raised in this particular case.
Counsel, if you could follow the argument that you advanced, that once 215 is enacted, versus if predecessors, even though with respect to the lowercase language, which indicates it wasn't touched when 215 was enacted, if you said it would be as if the prior language never existed.
The prior, under the analysis is House Bill, or excuse me, Schubert said House Bill 350 is unconstitutional. So, and the case law, again, running by this court, is the effect of House Bill 350 is if those statutes had never existed. But before, in Schubert, only dealt with House Bill 350. So after that, after House Bill 350 was enacted, and prior to Schubert, the legislature had changed it. They'd come in and said, now here's the statute, here's the final appealable order clause. So we don't have to get back to going back and saying, well, it followed from and it was a reenactment. I prefer to call it an enactment. That was the first time that it actually existed. If the legal effect,
if it were in the act, then clearly it would have had the upper case to achieve that.
Correct. Now, do we throw out all the House Bill 215? It is perhaps, and I don't think that that's the case before this court. We also relied in the Court of Appeals on the issue of the special proceeding and substantial evidence in the special proceeding. As an alternative basis for jurisdiction.
Now, am I correct that the underlying case is here too?
Yes, and let me go back to that. Just
we took that in.
The underlying case is a certified question
and combined.
And combined the two, correct. The question was asked earlier, what if we find there is no jurisdiction, what happens? There's a case that is already in this court right now, out of the same judicial district. It's called Haynes versus City of Franklin. The same issue has just been certified by that court, same certified conflict between jurisdictions.
You mean if we find it was not a special proceeding?
Correct. That case is working its way through the system right now. The Court of Appeals in that case in Haynes, so you're going to have to deal with it here very shortly.
Sure. Your response to Mr. Willsby, he doesn't have to wait all that long, I guess, for an answer to the underlying question.
And it's the same issue, that exact same conflict with what the Court of Appeals
is. But it is here, so I'd like to deal with the
correct. I mean, I'm sorry.
Isn't it clear that the Court of Appeals just brushed aside the trial court's determination that this was a jury question, this 7-inch drop-off, by 7.5-inch drop-off next to the pavement, and they looked at this case of the Ohio Supreme Court and said, well, you know, this is a pockle or a chuckle like a case, so as a matter of law, there's no case.
I don't believe that they brushed it off. I wouldn't call it that, what the analysis was, which is consistent with Polis and this court, was that it followed the decision of this court, the manufacturer's Hanover case and Frank versus Lopez case, which interpreted what is a nuisance. And the language used in the manufacturer's case, and consistently, is that the condition must affect normal traffic on the regularly traveled portion of the road in defining nuisance under the statute 2744.2.
So you think this court has said that if you've got a 6-inch or a 1-foot drop-off right on the edge of the pavement, that can't come, that's not a jury question?
That is not a jury question. As a matter of law, it does not constitute a nuisance. And you have to keep in mind, too, what facts we're looking at in this particular case. We have a roadway here that is sufficiently wide for traffic. It is maintained, it has been paved, there is well marked. There is a white line on the road delineating the edge of the pavement.
So then, theoretically, there'd be no need for guardrails either. You could just have a 50-foot drop-off. As long as your pavement's wide enough to travel.
That is correct. Those are discretionary decisions that are entitled to immunity. And perhaps if we look at it, perhaps adding a little different fact pattern. Suppose we have a block curb same distance from the white line, or we have a guardrail same distance from the white line. Driver loses control, bounces off the curb, bounces off the guardrail, goes into the opposing lane of traffic, and goes past me. That's what we're, same situation, same effect. Loses control, bounces off something, and oversteers, goes in the other lane of traffic.
It's not quite the same.
It is the same, because now could that driver or the injured person say, well, that was a nuisance, it caused me to go in the other lane of traffic. Because that's what this driver says happened. I went off the pavement edge, lanes were marked, a rainy day, this is a curving road.
Well, but the guardrail is installed for safety. The 6 or 3.5 or 7 inch drop off of the road certainly is not safety, is it? I mean, let that occur, let it exist.
But what is being asked here by Stephen, is to extend the definition of what the roadway is and what can be potentially be a nuisance.
What do we do with the first branch of the syllabus in Diggerhoff? I mean, the Court of Appeals cited it, said it was helpful, but then sort of just that it doesn't apply because it was written before the statute was amended, but it's pretty, failing to keep a shoulder of a highway in repair and free from nuisance states a claim on which relief can be granted.
Diggerhoof, and I have to go back historically, because I don't think Diggerhoof at this point should be the law in Ohio, and I think it ought to be either reversed or modified in some respect. At the time Diggerhoof was decided, there was no sovereign immunity statute. There wasn't a political subdivision liability act. There was not, at that particular point, any act at all, as we have here. And this court...
But the statute did require the municipality to keep roads free from nuisance, didn't it? Isn't that...
That's correct. But then the language was a little bit different, too.
Right.
And then we since have had, in interpreting statutory language, we've had manufacturer's handover case and the other subsequent cases to deal with conditions on the regular travel portion of the road. And which is that the condition must affect safety of travel, normal traffic, on the regular travel portion of the road.
Mr. Gary, this is probably a threshold question, should have been asked earlier, but I come to it after your discussion now. Aren't these all factually driven?
No, Your Honor, they're not. Once again,
I mean, whether it's 6 inches or too close or a wider road, you think there's a real conflict here?
Conflict in...
Between the two cases. Between, they certified to us this issue.
Yes,
sir.
Yes.
You think there's a conflict?
Obviously,
on an issue of law.
It is an issue of law. First of all, the trial court has to treat it as an issue of law. Can this condition, when it is off the regular travel portion of the road, be considered a nuisance in light of the statute and this court's pronouncements and manufacturer in other cases? Is that an issue of law?
So,
based on So we disagree with the facts, we concede that that's what she's saying.
So in other words, clearly as a matter of law, whether as a matter of law, this is what they certified, an edge drop on a city or county road constitutes a nuisance within the meaning of 2744.
That's
a question of law.
That's correct.
And those two cases are in conflict on that issue.
I believe they are in conflict. And the Thompson case didn't analyze that case, mm-hmm. either in terms of the manufacturer's handling or the other appellate decisions of this jurisdiction in the state of Ohio. The Lescue's one case in Hendricks, which is an identical fact matter, in which those courts said, as a matter of law, we find that this is an edge run. Does not constitute a nuisance. It's not in the regular general portion of the
law. Which case is that?
The Valesque case, Your Honor, which is out of Cuyahoga County.
David, I'm coming back to manufacturers. You say that stands for the proposition that it isn't a nuisance?
The standard is the condition. What must the condition affect? It must affect the safety of normal traffic on the regularly traveled portion of the road. And we submit that this is not normal traffic. Ms. The driver wasn't operating normally. And the regularly traveled portion of the road was well marked, well defined.
So we would have to resolve manufacturers and differ and decide which is the better case to follow.
Well, I believe Dicker group too. If you look at the fact pattern of Dicker group, that was only on a complaint issue, and it was a 12B6 motion that resolved by this court. There were no facts other than a complaint, once again. In this court, footnote, I believe, said we don't know whether this was a burn, whether it was a burn that was constituted and established.
In Dicker, they said it's a fact question for the prior fact.
Yeah, but since that point, this court has said these are legal issues properly determined by summary judgment. Particularly in the Conlon case, the immunity is an issue that is determined as a legal issue. And so what you have to look at is this is a legal issue. I know my time is up. If you have any other questions, we ask you to affirm the lower court.
The conflict case, Thompson did say, did it not, that the issue of whether a 6-inch edge drop of a berm constitutes a nuisance is a question of fact.
I believe it did, and that's where we believe it was in error, Your Honor, because the other courts all said it is a legal issue that ought to be determined in light of this court.
So our question of law that's required to be certified is this a question of law or a question of fact? First time I've seen it.
Perhaps inherent in all of that, yes, Your Honor, I believe somewhere you have to get there.
Thank you, Mr. Gary. Mr. Willis, you've used your time to take 30 seconds, if you like.
I just want to point out quickly that Dickerhoof was cited with approval in manufacturing. And since manufacturers, this court has also cited Dickerhoof with approval in Williamson versus Pavlovich. And the only distinction that can be made about all of these edge drops, ruts, whatever you want to call them, is the name you apply to it. And this court has said that the issue is not the nature or the name of this purported nuisance, it's the effect. And the only evidence in this record is that edge drop made the regularly traveled portion of the road unsafe for traffic. That's the only factual evidence in this record. And so you have to throw Dickerhoof out to rule against it. The business about summary judgment being a question of law, immunity being a question of law, yes, if there are no questions of fact on these types of issues. That Conley case, the very next sentence after that statement about the question of law says, unless there are questions of fact about the underlying merits of the case. The most recent case was the immunity case Hart. This case decided this year, this court decided this year, that said a rut in the shoulder is a potential nuisance. A rut, an edge drop, a chuck hole, it's all the same. What does it do to the regular travel portion of the road? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wills. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All right.